Net-a-Porter presents the Incredible Women Podcast, Series 8, The Powerhouses.
Welcome to this series of the Incredible Women Podcast, in partnership with De Beers, in which we sit down with women who are leading the charge in their industries, those who are admired for their unique talent, strength, drive, and influence. All at the top of their game, some of these incredible women you'll already be familiar with, and others we're excited to introduce you to. I'm Kay Barron, Fashion Director at Net-a-Porter, and I'm delighted to be joined for this episode of our Powerhouses series by Eva Chen, journalist, author, and Vice President of Fashion Partnerships at Meta.
And I think that balance is ultimately a very tricky word, right? Especially as women, we're constantly told to find balance, seek balance, work-life balance, 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 balance. And what no one really talks about is how balance is intrinsically like a temporary state. Balance is not a real thing.
Eva says that her love of beauty and fashion was instilled in her by her mother, whose scarlet lipstick and perfect bob made an imprint on her impressionable young mind. That passion led her into the world of magazines, where she worked at Harper's Bazaar, Elle and Teen Vogue, before Anna Wintour appointed her as the youngest ever editor-in-chief of Lucky magazine. In 2015, she joined Instagram to develop partnerships with fashion brands, which was a perfect fit, for no one knows how to create content quite like Eva, which she does on a regular basis to her dedicated 2.5 million followers. But while she documents much of her life with her husband and three children, there is still so much I'm excited to find out. So let's welcome Eva. Because this series is called The Powerhouses, and obviously we think you are one, but what does the term powerhouse mean to you, and how has the perception of power changed throughout your career?
Well, the concept of power definitely changes and has changed throughout my life. You know, you start out as a teen or whenever you start thinking about the word power as something really detached from you, or for me, certainly, as a first generation Chinese American girl growing up, it always felt like it was decisions being made in rooms far removed. And I think now, especially as a woman in my 40s, the word power has come to mean something else. It's a little bit more of a holistic word. It's more organic, and it also represents more than professional power. I think that the power women hold and yield is so much more nuanced than these two-dimensional representations of power that are just about the workplace. So I think there's personal power, there is family power, and coming into your power really means something. I think that there's a lot of pressure, especially for young people, especially for teens, to become most fully realized adults by the time they finish university. I've always wanted to say, especially to, I talk to a lot of recent graduates, that, you know, a career in power and the concept of growth is ever evolving, and you never really feel like you fully arrived. And so I think power is something that's ever shifting, ever changing, and that people should actually learn to embrace uncertainty and kind of just the shifting sands of themselves, you know, throughout time. So I don't know if that fully answers the question, but I would say that the term powerhouse really means evolution to me.
And how do you use the power that you have?
It really depends day to day. I think so many people would probably identify with me in saying that every day, especially as a mom of three, my battery reserves are wildly different. And so how empowered I feel personally really varies from day to day. I mean, a goal of mine is to, if I can help other people feel empowered, or if I can help other people feel like they have some clarity, whether it's in their career, whether it's talking with a friend and helping her with, you know, something that's going on in her life, that to me feels empowering. And so I think really power is less about these big sweeping changes that people can make that might affect the public policy for this country. I mean, I think that's what I used to think power meant. And I think power much more is about personal power and the ripple effect that you have in your own life on the people that you come across day to day. I think that's actually a much more impactful type of power where you're impacting the people around you day to day.
And on a much wider scale as well than just the people, obviously, that you're in real life with too, thanks now to social media. And I think because obviously the way that you use social media, I always think about how you think that you know what people do. But then I was like, actually, I don't know what the Vice President of Fashion Partnerships at Meta is in terms of your day-to-day. So please do tell me what it is.
My parents.
Yes, but speak to me like you're telling your mom what
you
do.
Yeah, you know, it's a really, really amazing job and I feel so fortunate to have it because it really does change every 6 months, basically. So the most simplistic way to describe to my mom and dad and you on my day-to-day job is basically I'm like the bridge between the fashion industry and Meta. My role in the beginning, because I came to Instagram after having been a magazine editor for 10 years and spending a lot of times behind the scenes. And in particular, like I loved my time as a beauty editor where I would be backstage at shows and I would be with like the Pat McGraths or the Guido Palaus and literally like watching them create this. And that's when for me, as a magazine editor, I was someone who was at the time on various social media platforms sharing the behind the scenes. I think I started about 8 years ago when there were still a lot of questions about Instagram. There were creative directors who would never dream to show the behind the scenes. And fashion was much more of this very produced, very perfect, very like, here's our ad campaign, period. You know, that's it. And you'll hear from us like four times a year, maybe like our fashion show, our ad campaign, and then like, that's it. And so my role was really to teach the fashion industry, models, designers, stylists, creative directors, you know, publications and editors even, how to bring a little bit of that behind the scenes into their day-to-day storytelling. Because the fashion industry ultimately is an industry about storytelling. It's about sharing. And there's a reason why the most luxury houses in the world talk about storytelling in their heritage, right? They talk about the dreams that they weave and the stories. And so much of the perception of fashion actually is linked intrinsically to storytelling. And so that was very much my role in the beginning. And my role has shifted throughout my time at Instagram and now at Meta, where one of the things that I found that was the most like, I would say, honestly, like astounding to me is that how much that the people who are designing the features of Instagram were curious about the way people in fashion used Instagram. Fashion is very much a lightning rod. Fashion is very much a culture carrier and a culture changer. We need only, like you and I are recording this a day after the Oscars, and what everyone is talking about is, yes, the best picture, great job, Oppenheimer. However, people are talking about the clothes and the fashion and the way that the actors and actresses are representing themselves through fashion. And so it was pretty cool to see that these product designers and product teams would say like, well, how would a model use this new feature that we're thinking about? How would this like groundbreaking creative director who everyone's obsessed with use this new feature? And so I've been at Instagram since the launch of Instagram Stories. I've been at Instagram through the launch of Reels and now through Threads. And so one of the most fun part of my jobs is working with those teams to bring back feedback from the fashion industry to help literally shape the user experience for Instagram. So if a model, for instance, with 50 million followers adapts a product and is having fun on Threads or using Reels in a really compelling way, we often see this like kind of trickle down effect with the rest of the industry and also with the population at large. And so that's a really fun part of my job is kind of testing out new features and sharing feedback from the fashion industry.
Well, you've obviously been so successful because the one show that banned social media this season, there was uproar.
You know, I do love that brand.
We all do.
My bank account does not love that brand. What I would say is that like Instagram is very much about conversation, period. So ironically, if you ban a show sometimes, especially for that brand, The Row, you know, it actually garners even more conversation. What ended up happening is there were illegal uploads, right? Because if you make something taboo, there's always someone who's going to break the rule. I thought that was kind of a bummer that it was like, you know, banned. And I think most people were respectful. I did feel like it was kind of a bummer that someone kind of flouted that rule. I'm sure they got a lot of engagement. So
they did. They also got named and shamed, though.
Oh, did they?
So, yeah. And I wouldn't want to be named and shamed by the Olsons.
No, I feel like that is the goal on your list of things not to have happen to you is probably being named and shamed by Mary-Kate and Ashley. Yeah, yep. No thanks.
No, thank you.
But conversation is conversation. And the photos that came out a few days later were really beautiful. And I'm sure they had 1.5 million business reasons to do what they did. But I mean, I personally love the conversation that happens. Like, I love seeing what fashion commentators you know, whether they're in Paris watching the shows, like so many of these like amazing new young voices, or, you know, it's a student at the Savannah College of Art and Design at SCAD or at Central St. Martin's or Parsons. You know, I feel like through Instagram, you can feed the dreams of the next generation. And I think that's so incredibly important to do because now more than ever, we need that creativity and we need that art in the world.
Yeah, definitely. And to make them part of the conversation.
Exactly.
From the back-to-back shared family bugs and viruses.
Oh, God.
The Chair in the Pond rescue. I was really invested in that, by the way. And obviously, I know that your children love reading and Titanic and Lego. So your life does seem very public. But how does that feel for you from the inside?
Oh, I guess I never really thought about it in that way, because for me, like, it's always been in my personality to share. You know, I was the first magazine editor. I think I was the first beauty editor at Condé Nast, for instance, to start a blog and to have a Tumblr on the side where I answered questions from readers, you know, answering questions about acne when I worked at Teen Vogue. And when I was at Lucky Magazine, you know, so much of what I wanted to do was kind of break down the walls of fashion. And we talked a lot about street style and we talked like, you know, it was not about gatekeeping. It was about quite the opposite. It was about sharing like all the inside secrets that fashion people knew. The Chinese restaurant that everyone goes to, you know, after hours in Paris. Like that was always very much my vibe. And so, you know, I think in terms of sharing, there's a lot I actually don't share. But it's funny that the things that I do share, people are like, wow, you share everything. But I actually don't. I just share things that like bring me joy and also like I don't think are particularly private domain. So I don't really overthink it, I guess. But there's a lot I don't share. And people are always surprised, like, you know, when they hear, like, I call myself, I think many people would probably understand, like, the sandwich generation of taking care of very young children and then also having aging parents, for instance. And there's a lot I don't share there. But the things I do, I all feel like are pretty lightweight. And like, who doesn't love Lego and Titanic? And if there is a chair that rolls down a hill into a pond that my poor husband then has to wade into while I'm screaming leeches, leeches, like, you know.
Which I thought that was very supportive.
Yeah, he's supportive.
And how do you switch off? And do you think it is important to switch off?
Yeah, I physically and mentally and socially switch off. Like right now, I'm very much in a switch off mode. I'm actually, some people are surprised to hear, like I consider myself very much an introvert. I think they call it like a performing introvert, where I'm able to go out and do meetings and like, you know, be out in big groups of people. But then it takes me a lot of time to recuperate from that. So I'm in like a switch off mode right now, surprisingly. The most important thing is that when you share, that it feels authentic and that you find joy from it. And, you know, it's funny because like sometimes I'll say to someone, like, they'll say like, well, I post a lot about my job, I do X, Y, and Z, but what I really love is like gardening, or what I really love is like wildlife, or what I really love is like, there's one actress and she and I, all we DM about is like fountain pens. Like we both are fountain pen enthusiasts. And so I think that when you find things that you like sharing about, you don't feel that burden or pressure to switch off as much, right? Like if you find things that feel really natural to you to share about and it doesn't feel like onerous or a burden, you might not want to switch off as much. But I do feel like it's important for people to refresh and renew and take breaks from whatever it is that's causing them stress. And if that means like switching off and going on a digital detox and going hiking and touching the grass, like by all means do that. But I personally like there's nothing I love more than like an Ask Me Anything on stories or in my broadcast channel. Like I actually get very energized by that because it reminds me of how helpful Instagram can be. I wish more people would do Ask Me Anythings because I have many questions for many people about like many things where I'm like, gosh, I really wish this like, you know, wildlife expert I follow could, you know, do an Ask Me Anything because I have questions. Or this like Cedric Grolet, you know, the baker in Paris who does
I have
those,
so many questions.
Oh, so many questions. Like how much butter does he use on a weekly basis? Like show us, Cedric. And so I really do enjoy doing it. I love answering questions. When I do an AMA, like I get anywhere from like 500 to 1500 questions in 24 hours. And I'm able to answer like 50 to 60 of them pretty efficiently. But then like, I enjoy doing it. So I guess this is a really long way of saying it's like, I think, yes, my job is social media. I do switch off, but like, I also enjoy it. And so it doesn't feel like stressful to me.
No, and I don't think that anything that you do post feels, everything feels genuine. And I think you can always, you know, you can see the joy in it, even not, maybe not when all the entire family's sick.
No, yeah, maybe
not. But it's
nice
to have that support then as well, I suppose.
Maybe not when we have like RSV, flu A, COVID, lice. I don't remember if I posted about the lice on Instagram.
I don't think you did.
It was maybe so horrific that I could not even post about it. It was a stressful time.
But how do you balance work, the kids, your personal life? Also, I mean, you're writing these inspirational children's books and then your personal projects. How do you have the time to do all of that?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that balance is ultimately a very tricky word, right? Especially as women, we're constantly told to find balance, seek balance, work-life balance, 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 balance. And what like no one really talks about is how balance is intrinsically like a temporary state. Balance is not a real thing. If you think about like, you know, these A-list gymnasts like Simone Biles, who's like endlessly, ceaselessly like inspiring, it's like she's not balancing on one foot on the balance beam for like hours, days, months, years. Like she falls, she comes down, and then it's like she has to get back up. And I feel like for women and for people kind of in this caretaking state, our life is in a constant state of balance and then like imbalance. And I think that was the biggest realization in my life, going from the decade of 30 to 40, going from the decade of having no kids and having complete like independence and autonomy, relatively speaking, to having young kids and constantly being kind of like, you know, managing their day to day. I think in terms of how I balance it is, well, first of all, I have an amazing team, like at home and also at work, right? Like I have a really, really supportive partner and I have parents who live close by to me and I have childcare, and these are all like deep, deep major privileges. And so I like have to acknowledge that very openly from the start. In terms of like balancing like the things that bring me passion and joy, like writing children's books, my whole life, like I always wanted to write children's books. I was very, 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 I was trying to describe this to my husband last night, actually. Like, I was basically like, I don't know if like nerd quite does it justice. I was a very late bloomer, I'll put it that way. And I like feel like I didn't have deep friendships growing up because I always felt a little bit different. I was, you know, bullied in school. I was one of very, very few Asians in the schools I went to, especially the younger years. For high school, it was better. I switched schools. And so I found a lot of like solace and escapism in books. And my parents worked, you know, as immigrants, they worked basically 7 days a week. I don't even know if 14 hours like does it justice, but like very, very long hours. And I was always with them, but I always had books with me. And so it was always my dream to write children's books. And the way I wrote children's books is basically like Roald Dahl, who's kind of canceled now, I think. I don't know if he's fully canceled, but his books, I mean, his books are magical. But like he described it, I think, in the BFG as this like witching hour. And it's between like 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. where like the world goes dead and silent. And I feel like that exists for parents as well. And it's usually around the same time when all your kids, hopefully, prayers, are asleep. And then like your email stops. And then like there's only so much more you can do. You can't like buy groceries. You can't think about reordering like rain boots for your kids. And that's when I wrote all my books, basically between like 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. usually. But children's books, listen, they're like 1,000 words. And then you work with an illustrator. And then the rest of it's done, most of it by emails or by Zooms. And all of the illustrators I've ever worked with have been on the West Coast. And so we would be doing Zooms and calls, kind of reviewing things, usually between the hours of like 9 p.m. And they all had day jobs as well. So it's like 9 p.m. and 11 p.m. we would do a Zoom sometimes to go over reviews. But it's like, because I love it so much, it always just felt like a privilege to do, honestly. So yeah, I feel like I'm quite disciplined in terms of my time. I have like, at any given point, like 6 calendars. It's like my work calendar, my personal calendar, 3 kids' calendars, color-coded, my parents' calendar, and then like my husband's calendar. Not that he needs me to manage it, but I like to know where he is. That sounds so creepy, but like, you know, it's so we can balance the childcare. And so I think that kind of like discipline in terms of time management. But again, I'm only able to do it because I have like a lot of support.
But that is amazing that you can be creative as well between those hours after working all day, having the kids all day, and then, because I think it's different to work or to reply to emails or something like from 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. But actually having to be creative and then to create is, that's an amazing skill to be able to do that.
I do it in spurts and then I can't do it every day. But it's also for me such an escape that the ability to be creative in that way is really important in a completely different way than the creativity that I have to tap into at work to be able to be creative on my personal hours. And for my children's books, it's like a different type of creativity. And it's quite rejuvenating, actually. But writing is also torture, like for the writers listening. And you know, you're nodding your head, Kay, like knowingly. Yep. Writing is torture. But it's like, you have to love it to do it. I cannot describe like the kind of joy that I feel when I go to a children's classroom, a child's classroom, and I read my book and the questions you get. And it's like, it's very, very life affirming. Like it makes me feel, have a lot of faith in humanity when you go into a classroom of like, you know, first graders or second graders and the questions they ask and just how like bright and optimistic, and it gives you a lot of hope. And so that's been really important for me personally.
Because I think it's that joy that you have when you've been trying to write for hours and then suddenly you write a sentence that you're really proud of.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, this is it. This is what I've been spending the last 8 hours trying to do.
Exactly. There's nothing more daunting or intimidating than like that blinking cursor.
Well, what was it that drew you to media in the first place?
Oh, well, so I studied medicine in college. I was pre-med. And I think that was very much kind of reaction and balance to, you know, my parents moved to America in the 70s, and I think a lot of first-generation Americans and first-generation around the world, honestly, like the greatest dream that immigrant parents have is stability for their own children, especially since if they had to struggle with instability, they want their kids to be in very stable careers. And so for me, I was pre-med. I thought I was going to be a doctor. I always have been interested in health and wellness, especially just, you know, I always loved it, and I did pretty well in science classes. And so the summer between my junior and senior year of college, I basically said that I wanted to do something completely different before like embarking on studying for the MCATs, which in the US is like the medical school admissions test. And so I applied to about 20 internships. And ultimately, the thing that motivated me to choose the one that I did was the fact that it was the only paid internship. And it was a job at Harper's Bazaar magazine in the US. And I was split between the beauty department and the features department. And it was like from day one, I walked into the office. It was on 57th Street between Broadway and 6th in the old Hearst building. And it was just like, I could feel like my soul just kind of strumming, like there was a like an or like a light just lighting up and being like, I just never put two and two together. I didn't realize, and this is pre-Instagram, of course, I didn't realize that like this thing that I'd always loved doing, I didn't realize that it was someone's job to like, you know, write about it. And so I was like, this is what I was meant to do. And so I don't know that I was drawn to media, but more that I had this like very fortunate, happy accident of just kind of falling into this like dream internship. And I never kind of looked back after that. And yeah, I ended up kind of having a, you know, decade plus career, long career in fashion publications, which I feel really fortunate to have been able to do. But I've always loved the written word. And when I look back at my life, and I feel like other people might identify with this, there were always clues that it would have been something. I always like felt much more natural, I guess. And it always came easier to me, like the English and the writing classes that I took. Whereas like with the pre-med classes, like to get like decent grades as pre-med, I went to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which is like a very, everyone goes there to be a doctor. Like I had to study for like, I mean, from 4 p.m. until like midnight to get like not even A's, like to get B pluses. So, the clues were there because like it felt much more effortless for me.
I take it there's no regrets about not being a doctor.
You know, with the amount of illnesses that my kids have had, you know, to have an MD under my belt would be helpful. Honestly, thinking back now, if I were to go back to med school, which obviously I could never, although, you know, you read stories about women in their 50s going to med school. And I think it's amazing. It's so inspiring. I probably would be a dermatologist because I love skincare and lasers and all of that jazz.
Well, I mean, personally, I'm thrilled that you didn't become a doctor and that we have you in the world of fashion. But do you have a plan for what's next as well?
No, I have no plan. I really feel like I've never had this like grandmaster plan. Like the things that have always guided me, I've always had less of a plan in terms of professional and career and more of like a, I guess, vision in terms of like family and home life. And I guess that like not having a plan has worked because like we all know the saying about the best laid plans, you know, it's like, and I think it's very true. And I kind of feel like that it's not a laissez-faire attitude, but like a looser attitude and guidelines. I think it is important to have both personally and professionally. So yeah, it's not really, I've had like, I guess not ideals, but like intentions, but not plans has always been, I guess, the way I've thought about it. And for me, as long as I feel fulfilled and challenged, like that's always been the most important thing. Like that itch of boredom, that first kind of prickle of kind of like, you know, like that's always been very lethal for me. But I feel really fortunate right now that like because of my job at, you know, at Meta, it's like it is constantly changing. I haven't had the opportunity to feel that yet, literally because things change every day in exciting ways and sometimes stressful, like when, you know, Threads launched over, you know, the biggest bank holiday and one of the biggest bank holidays in the US, but you're like, okay, this is exciting. Like, who knew that this would happen? You kind of learn to roll with it and have fun with it.
With everything you were doing, I don't think there's any time for any prickles of boredom, even that first one. So that is, that's a bonus, at least, I suppose. You always seem so excited about fashion and never jaded. And I loved seeing you signing autographs outside shows in Paris or Milan.
That was like very weird, by the way. That's like happened. I was like very surprised by that.
How do you maintain that enthusiasm with all the demands that come with your schedule and the work that you have to do?
I have never felt like a true fashion insider. I think that probably helps. And I know there are people who are going to hear that and kind of like roll their eyes. But like, I've always felt more of like a fashion enthusiast and like a fashion kind of fan. And there are people in the fashion industry, like an Andrew Bolton or, you know, a Mark Holgate from Vogue. And you're literally like, you just sit there with your hand on your chin and you're like, oh my God, like when Andrew Bolton talks about fashion in such like a intellectual, philosophical and like kind of able to like kind of talk about like Elizabethan fashion and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh my God, this is like a true fashion brain, like a fashion like genius, basically. And so I think I've always had this perspective of fashion from the outside, I guess. And what I love right now is I love to see this new generation of fashion commentators, whether it's like a style.com. I love Jose Criales, who is a young writer at Vogue. There is a fashion content creator named Nime Nodolo. I like love her, like that adult. There's one named Old Loser in Brooklyn, which you know from her username that she's funny. But it's like, I love this new generation of commentators who bring humor and like a sense of personality and a sense of levity to fashion, because I do think fashion can be extremely serious and intellectual, and it should be. And I think it's very important that we have voices that are able to dissect it and appreciate the history of it. But for me, it's like just because I feel like I've always had one foot on the outside from my upbringing, from the magazines I've worked at. I was a beauty editor for many years, not a fashion editor. And I've always did kind of feel like that more behind the scenes kind of aspect. So I think that's why I'm like ultimately like I'm able to find joy and humor in it, because like I'm not supposed to be the center of it. I'm like the supporting actor.
Well, that's where you're using your power too and giving them a platform or lending them your platform.
I mean, for me, it's like I think back, like I mentioned, I was very shy and awkward in school. And like, I always loved like the musicals that were being performed every year at school. But I knew I didn't, like, I wasn't one, I cannot sing, like, to my way out of a, I cannot sing. And I would get very nervous on stage at the time. But like the way I was able to be involved in the musicals is like my job was, I was like the lighting director. My job was to literally shine a spotlight on other people. Like that's what I did for 3 years in high school, was like take the spotlight. I had the script in front of me. I felt like I was part of it, but my job was to swing that giant light on the star. And I do feel like my role at Instagram is to help people find their voice on the platform and to help them like step into the light a bit. And so that's just always been my philosophy. And it all kind of, there's no such thing as wasted experience, you know? And so I think back to myself in high school and that's what I did then. And I do feel like that's a big part of what I do now.
You're still a lighting director.
I guess so. Where's my ring light? Now it's just ring lights, though.
But finally, what I want to ask you was, who are the powerhouse women who are inspiring you in 2024?
It's been a landmark year, I think, for women in some ways. But then at the same time, I think there's just so much more to be done. And so I think the powerhouse women that really inspire me are really like, I look to more to the everyday and to the women around me who are making change every day. I think in when you look at the trajectory of women, there was a period of years where everyone was like liberally using the word girl boss, right? And, it did always feel a little saccharine and kind of overused, right? And even the word like girl is infantilizing for women who are just bosses, period. And I hope that especially in the U.S., which is, you know, when civil liberties and women's ownership over themselves has been challenged, disappointingly, you know, over the last 8 years. My hope is that in 2024, the powerhouse women are the ones who are every day rallying for change and pushing for change and pushing the boundaries of what's possible. I know it's happening. I mean, I see with this Generation Alpha especially, there's a lot written about Gen Alpha and Gen Z, and a lot of the articles are kind of like, oh, isn't it silly that they'll go into a beauty store in X, Y, and Z? Or isn't it, you know, Gen Z with their obsession with like these phone cases or this and that? And it's like, well, not to be, I have not seen Devil Wears Prada, this is a thing, but like, I know there's a big lecture about like, you know, the finances of fashion and like the power of women in fashion. But it is, it's like, I do see this incredible generation. I see it every day when I go into the classroom. I see it every day when I go to my kids' schools. Like this generation is a generation that is going to change the world. They have such strong morals and strong belief. And so I think in 2024, it's less about powerhouse women, but it's about a powerhouse generation that I hope is coming to the forefront. And I hope that the women and people around the world, like I hope that we can cultivate that talent and give them power and give them credence and give them a platform, because I see the changes they're making, and they're going to change the world.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today. I could actually talk to you all day long.
Yay. Great. It's nice to meet you.
And yeah, I mean, such amazing nuggets in there as well. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
The Powerhouses was brought to you by Net-a-Porter and Chalk and Blade, hosted by Net-a-Porter's content director Alice Casely-Hayford and fashion director Kay Barron. The team at Net-a-Porter was Katie Berrington as the senior editor, with casting by Annabelle Brog and Olivia Wakefield, and coordination by Gabriella Pereira. The producer at Chalk and Blade was Laura Hyde, with help from Emily Wally. Original music by Alexis Adamora, and the series was mixed by Nasson da Silva. To make sure you hear all the episodes in this series, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, go to net-a-porter.com.